I'm John Golia.
And I'm Greg Fife. And we are
the Flight Safety Detectives.
We're just two guys who have spent most of their career with the National Transportation Safety Board investigating aircraft disasters and aviation safety issues all over the world.
Yep, and this podcast is where we talk about everything from accidents, airplane technology, to the big business of aviation.
We live and breathe aviation. My co-host John has been in the aviation business for more than 60 years. He was the first and only airframe and power plant mechanic to get a presidential appointment to the National Transportation Safety Board.
And Greg is a former air safety investigator and GO team captain for the NTSB. He's investigated everything that flies worldwide since he started his career 40 years ago. And on top of that, he is a living Legends of Aviation inductee.
So between John and myself, we have over 100 years of aviation safety experience. It's time to buckle up because it's going to be wheels up. Let's get this show in the air. We're going to talk on this particular episode with regard to Ethiopian Airlines and their 737 MAX accident that occurred in March of 2019, some of the preliminary issues, and of course, some of the certification issues and oversight issues by the Ethiopian government. So with that, I want to turn it back over to John to introduce our special guest.
Again, we have with us today George Snyder, who is the president and CEO of GHS Aviation Group. And he's a friend and a former VP of safety for U.S. Airways, as well as the former VP of safety and security for Korean Airlines. And he has extensive experience in the Asian and Pacific environment. And he does safety audits around the world, helping companies make themselves better. And we welcome his thoughts and his ideas to help make things better.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Greg.
It's good to see you again. One of the things that we're talking about today, and again, John and I have a lot of conversations offline about a lot of these issues, so we always appreciate the expertise that somebody like you brings into the conversation. So with that being said, Ethiopian Airlines, the 737 MAX that crashed several months after the Lion Air 737 MAX, all of a sudden now the focus, of course, has been brought to the 737, the Boeing company, as far as their certification process, of course, our FAA. But we have to turn back and look at Ethiopian Airlines. I mean, one of the things that we've seen is that there aren't a lot of, if any, maintenance issues being developed with that particular accident. It's more operationally focused with that flight crew and the flight training. And so with all of that, what do you see in a global perspective from an operational standpoint that the at least the investigative authorities should be focusing on in that particular investigation?
Greg, I think there's a lot of things that not just that part of the world, but the entire industry is sort of waking up to. You highlighted the certification process. You highlighted the relationship between the OEM and the FAA in this country, which is being reviewed. We don't, as you've correctly indicated, the final report is on the Ethiopian accident has not yet been issued. There's been some preliminary information, which I think you're going to speak with later on. But from a maintenance and airworthiness point of view, this was essentially a brand new airplane with essentially brand new components and systems installed. There were no, at least to the best of my knowledge, there were no previous discrepancies, chronic repetitive technical issues with the airplane. From an airworthiness point of view, it seemed to have been an excellent aircraft.
But some of the preliminary information that has come out is that the AOA vane is in question with its reliability and operation. There's been discussions about the fact that either it failed or it actually came off the aircraft because of a potential or possible bird strike that resulted then in an unreliable airspeed issue that the crew was posed with.
Yeah, that's what the preliminary information is. It seems to... The seminal event seems to be something to do with the AOA equipment that either malfunctioned, as you said, was involved with some sort of structural impact, or shortly after liftoff was just providing inaccurate information to the flight crew.
And while we're probably going to come back with you later on in another episode to talk more and more about these training issues and some of the ramifications of the elements of this investigation as they come out, especially at the final report, the big question I think now is, how well are these pilots, not only at Ethiopian Airlines, but worldwide? How well is our training programs and the tools that the pilots have available for training to give them all the necessary information and background that they need to operate an aircraft, especially as advanced as these airplanes are getting in this environment today?
It's an excellent point, Greg. I think way back when, many years ago, when I joined the airline industry, there were a lot of extremely experienced flight crew on board the airplanes. In fact, 10,000 hours was considered an average for the commander. 5,000, 4,000 hours was considered an average for the second in command. So an airline, when they hired these people, had only really to polish their skills in the particular aircraft type that they're going to be hired on, to bring them up to the level of proficiency and expertise that they needed to operate the aircraft. Today, that same experience level is not available worldwide. We've probably could have a separate discussion on that. But the airline training programs fundamentally have not changed. So if you have experience that is not what it used to be, supplemented by sort of a legacy training program, we have some challenges. And those challenges are overcome by getting good information from the OEM that we feed into the full flight simulators so that we can train and check these pilots on what they may experience during normal line operations. Today, the simulator fidelity on level C and level D simulators almost exactly replicates the aircraft most of the time. But as we found out early on after several upset event accidents, the simulator fidelity in certain conditions that are outside of the flight test envelope of the aircraft, the simulator cannot, by definition, replicate them. So if you're training pilots in an area where the simulator does not have a high level of fidelity, you're not giving them a value. And in fact, under some circumstances, it's even negative training.
On the training issue, George, we have a standard for training around the world. It's called ICAO. International Civil Aviation Organization. It's part of the United Nations, and they have a set of minimum training for virtually everybody in aviation. Do you think that today's environment is adequately addressed by the ICAO standard for training?
ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, provides a set of standards and recommended practices in various disciplines, and they provide that information under the Chicago Convention to be signed on by the various ICAO member states, of which many of the states we're talking about are signatories. It gives guidance, and again, it's not a regulatory issue. It is guidance. The standards for training and checking of airmen and aircraft ground engineers are very generic, and they vary significantly from one state to another. So when you get a member state that has an excellent civil aviation authority underneath it, those standards are equivalent and sometimes surpass some of the standards in Europe and North America. In other cases, that they don't necessarily are not outside over and above the standards in North America and Europe. But at the end of the day, and as you've correctly indicated, there are standards that must be maintained by the flight crew, and both for initial and recurrent training.
And you bring up a good point about the fact that ICAO is only recommended practices and standards.
Yes, sir.
Given the fact that they don't have any teeth, who's going to hold them accountable as far as the member state or the carrier with regard to the operating standard or the training standard? And then with a follow-up to that, because these member states that have an investigative authority, they can do things in an independent way. Here in the United States, we have NTSB, which is the Independent Acts Investigation Authority. Ethiopia does not have that. Their government is running the investigation without having that level of independence. So how is it that they're going to be held accountable if they put out a report that biases the fact that their pilots were great, the airline was great, and it was a bad airplane, when in fact all the facts, conditions, and circumstances may not support that?
Really raised two excellent questions. One, how does the international aviation industry sort of police itself over and above ICAO, over and above the state civil aviation authorities? And IATA has really done us a great service by creating the IATA Operational Safety Audit Evaluation Program. This is a set of almost, it's 895 standards in eight different disciplines that a airline to become IOSA registered and meet these international standards has to successfully complete. So over and above the civil aviation regulatory oversight, now we have IOSA, which is a set of standards highly above, and Ethiopian Airlines was one of the first airlines to be IOSA registered. Secondly, the concept of the Autonomous Independent Acts Investigation Board, that is something that the importance cannot be overstated.
And when you were with Korean Air, of course, I was the investigator in charge on the Korean Air 801 accident in Guam.
Yes.
And out of that investigation, the safety board made a recommendation, because at the time, Korea didn't have an independent investigative authority. Yet we made the recommendation, and the Koreans did, in fact, create this independent investigative authority. But we also made recommendations to Korean Air for changes. Can you just give us a real nutshell of what changes that you incorporated based on that accident?
Well, first of all, the NTSB did a tremendous service to Korea, to the industry, by making that recommendation for an independent autonomous investigation bureau, which in fact the Korean government implemented almost immediately after the recommendation was made. People were identified within the Korean government. They were trained right here in Washington through the NTSB Academy, shadowed you and a lot of the other investigators in charge to really learn how to conduct a comprehensive, objective, and a valuable investigation. So that helped. That helped Korea, and that helped the world. Secondly, when you made the recommendations to Korean Air, there was some significant changes made to driven by the corporate cultural change, where we started to really take our training and evaluation seriously, we brought it up almost immediately to international standards. They were always at the regulatory standards for Korea, but they were brought up a little above. So again, the recommendations that were made were immediately implemented, and it's made Korean Air the safe airline that it is today.
And one of those recommendations, even though it didn't name you by name, Korean Air did reach out. They went overseas. They brought in you as their vice president of safety and security, which brought in a different perspective, given your airline background and that kind of thing. Do we really see that there's going to be any kind of recurrence of the issues that we developed with 801 in the future for Korean Air, or have they been mitigated or eliminated in the training or the operations of the airline?
I think one of the recommendations to bring in outside expertise, and we had an excellent gentleman by the name of Mr. David Greenberg, former Delta Airlines Exec VP of Operations, myself, another gentleman, Captain Bill Hardy from Canada. It just brought in some outside expertise, a different perspective. And it brought in the quality assurance program, which speaks to exactly what you're talking about, not allowing any type of degradation of safety standards, to ensure and continually assure that systems, process, and controls are in fact delivering the desired results and not allowing it to go back to the past.
George, one of the criticisms that I often hear about certain cultures, Asian, a lot of Asian, is that the captain is the senior person on the airplane and the other crew members don't ever want to raise any issues with them, don't want to say anything negative, bring bad news to the boss, so to speak. How did you overcome that in Korean Airlines?
We had a great group of people to work with. We obviously, 7 fatal hull losses in 5 years brings an urgency to the organization that things that have been done in the past can no longer continue. The corporate culture that was changed within Korean Air is really sort of a gold template. It should be the role model for other cultural changes going forward. We did not dispute the autonomy of Korean culture and tradition. We did not want to change any of the practices outside of the airplane. But what we did establish was when you were on a Korean Air flight deck, you were similar to being in an embassy in another country. While outside of that flight deck or outside of that embassy, it was the laws of the state on which the embassy was located. But once you walk through those gates, once you walk through that flight deck door, it was a separate autonomous safety culture that was consistent with the aviation industry practices at that time, separate and apart from any of those command authority issues that you've referred to. Once you're on a Korean Air flight deck, that is the way you operated. Once you were outside, we went back to normal culture and tradition.
How long did that transition take?
3 to 5 years is sort of the global template from the time someone or an organization indicates that a cultural change needs to take place. To have that fully ingrained, not just on the surface, but to have that culture and those traditions actually taking place when supervisory people are not looking on a Saturday night, late at night, when no foreman or no check pilots are looking, it takes 3 to 5 years. And the constant reinforcement that Greg was talking about.
That's going to be probably the subject of another episode with you because, you know, everybody wants instantaneous change and they want it now. And if there's a deficiency identified, they expect that the airline's going to implement it. And overnight, they're going to have, you know, the best pilots or the best mechanics, you know, operating, and that airline's going to be at 100% safety. And so I know that we're going to bring you back for sure to talk about these things and the transitions and what it takes to change not only an organizational culture, but of course a safety culture, both here in the United States and abroad. So again, we want to say thanks again, as always, for coming down and being on the show with us. You bring a high level of expertise.
Yes, George, thank you very much. And when we come back, I probably want to talk to you more about how you drove the change within the maintenance department. I know that at one point in time you had me over there, and I spent a fair amount of time with your maintainers, and it was impressive.
Great group of people, and thank you so much for your personal commitment to come over there. And Greg, as IIC on 801, you really, truly helped contribute to that cultural change at Korean Air. Thank you.
Well, Greg, that was a very interesting discussion we had with George, raising a lot of very good points, and actually gave me a couple of issues to think about as we go forward with this podcast and with the investigations. Certainly, they get very complicated when you get to countries that don't have an independent accident investigation element to their government. And in fact, in Ethiopia, with the government owning the airline, as well as being the Secretary of Transportation, being the spokesman for the investigation, it raises some serious concerns. So you've operated in that environment in the past, and maybe you can share with us some of the problems that you had in those environments and what you've seen.
Well, one of the big things, John, and again, having worked at the NTSB, and you were a vital part of that, when we are tasked with doing an acts investigation, whether it's here in the United States or assisting a foreign authority as technical advisors, our primary purpose is to develop thorough and methodical processes so that we can develop all of the factual information, such as the facts, conditions, and circumstances of the accident. The whole process of developing all that factual information isn't just to find out what the cause of the accident was and point the finger at somebody, but in fact, it is to identify those issue or issue areas that caused or contributed to the accident, but really form the basis for safety recommendations that are going to improve aviation safety, whether it's here in the United States with our regulatory authority or an aircraft manufacturer or an operator. But that same premise follows suit all over the world. And by not having an independent investigative authority like they have in Ethiopia. They have the government doing the investigation. How is it that they're going to be able to point the finger at themselves if they are, in fact, a contributor to the whole process? And that is especially with oversight. We look, the NTSB looks at the FAA to see if they were deficient in their oversight. And we see that quite a bit. If you read every blue cover report, the FAA is always discussed by the NTSB in some way, shape, or form. Now the question is, how is it that a non-independent investigative authority such as Ethiopia can look in the mirror and say, yes, we were a problem. We had deficient oversight. They should have done more things at the carrier. The training programs should have been better.
We had those exact same problems here in the United States. I can remember years ago when the CAB was in the investigative authority for aircraft accidents. And many, many people were unhappy with that. And finally, in 1966, Congress created the NTSB, which started life in 1967. And even then, they kept the NTSB under the Department of Transportation. And it didn't take but a few years before problems came up with that, because the Secretary of Transportation was, I'll use the word, interfering with the investigations to the point where the outcry from both the NTSB personnel and other people in the industry got louder and louder. And finally, in the early 70s, I think it was 1972, it might have been 71, Congress said enough, and they made the NTSB an independent authority and gave the NTSB, by law, it's right in the structure, the actual law itself that says that the NTSB is expected to criticize other agencies by name when there's a deficiency.
And we see that in life. We see that in life. It's real easy for us to be critical of others. It's very difficult for us to be self-critical, especially if we think we had some contribution to whatever event may not have turned out as we planned. And that's why it's so important that we have these independent investigations worldwide, because we're all out for the same bottom line, and that is to improve aviation safety in some way, shape, or form. But if there's going to be a slant to the way the facts, conditions, and circumstances are presented or interpreted, and those slants have an adverse effect on the bottom line, who was going to be held accountable for what? And then, of course, how do you develop a good safety recommendation to improve the system if you really don't have the proper perspective?
It's important for everybody. You know, if on the 737 MAX issues, we did not have any problems in the United States. If we only focused on the United States, there would have been no improvements to the frog. All right. But by having information coming into us worldwide from operators, it's going to change the system. We've seen it on other airplanes, not just the MAX. We've seen it in the system. You know, Americans fly on all these foreign airplanes, as do the Dutch and the French and so on and so on. All right. This is a worldwide representative of people.
Yes.
And having a investigative body that can make observations, opinions, and recommendations based across the board without fear of retribution in their own country is very, very important.
Absolutely. And we've seen it here over and over and over again where, you know, Americans flying on not only U.S. flag carriers, but overseas. We see folks in France and we see folks in Europe and even in Asia demanding someone to be held accountable. And while we don't like that term with regard to accident investigation, we're not trying to hold people accountable from a litigation point of view. We are trying to understand who had the responsibility, why did that responsibility fail, and if it did fail, then how are we going to fix that so that these folks are accountable or responsible, whether it is a government agency, an airline, or any other alphabet organization that has some contribution to that event. And I think that is, again, one of those things that to have that independence, it's going to be real interesting to see what the Ethiopians put out as far as a report to see how slanted it is. We saw that in brevity a little bit with the preliminary report, the report that they wrote about the flight, the way it was presented by the Minister of Transport in her briefing of the international press. It was 180 degrees out of phase. The facts were cited in the report, but the way she interpreted those facts made that sound like their pilots and their airline were the best in the world and that it was a bad airplane. And that is not necessarily true.
You know what it reminds me of? Where we were with politics in this country, and maybe in some cases where we are with politics in this country, is the politicians will say whatever they want, regardless of the facts. Whatever it takes to get their point across, for them to make it seem like they know what they're doing, they will say it. But the facts come in behind it, and you're wrong. I mean, we see it today with so many of these news organizations that are doing fact check on what our politicians say on the campaign trail. And it seems like every single time they do that, they identify a whole bunch of things that were less than 100% accurate and truthful. So hopefully we're not going to see that in either one of these investigations, but we'll have to wait to see.
Well, while we don't want to jump the gun because we don't know what's going to be in either the Indonesian report on Lion Air or the Ethiopians report about their 737 MAX accident, I think that this call to action should be not only worldwide, but definitely focused here in the United States. The NTSB is a technical advisor to the investigative authority over in Ethiopia. They have the power to at least make a recommendation in their submission as part of the process to recommend, like we did with Korea and through the Korean Air investigation, that they create an independent investigative authority that falls in line with the recommended practices and standards of ICAO. And I think that a call to action, if that does not happen or they balk at that, I think that the folks, at least here in the United States, should be on the phone or letter writing campaign to their congressman that gets the United States government to push that issue, because we do need thorough and methodical investigations that are unbiased, that have no perspective other than to interpret properly and fairly the facts, conditions, and circumstances for the sole purpose of enhancing aviation safety.
And we've seen in the U.S. how family members can drive part of that process. We've got changes in the U.S. to certification of pilots. I mean, we have today the 1,500-hour rule that was driven by the family members out of the Kogan crash in Buffalo, New York. I think we've had a number of Americans that were perished on these accidents in Lion Air and in Ethiopia, and those family members should be pushing real hard here in Washington to get the NTSB to do whatever they can do as part of the investigation. It isn't just influencing it inside the tent, so to speak, while the investigation is going on, but they can actually write an independent report if they feel so motivated, if they think it's so convoluted. But it takes a little bit of pressure on the government for them to take that step. That is a pretty drastic step.
Well, while you and I could probably talk the rest of the day about all of these issues, we're going to wrap this podcast up. But for you, the audience, if you have any questions, any comments, please feel free to provide those to us, because we like to read them. And of course, we'd like to address them in the following podcast. So if you have those questions or comments, concerns, and that kind of thing, please drop us an email at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com.
And that's detectives with an S. I made the mistake trying to get on myself. So
you're cutting me out of this detective thing? Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, John. I'm not sure that we're going to be partners much longer. So anyway, well, thanks for listening to this episode, and we look forward to having you involved with us in this show. Hopefully it brings good perspective to some of the issues that you don't necessarily get to read or see on TV or in the mainstream media. So again, till our next episode, I'm Greg Fife.
I'm John Golia.
And have a safe flight.
To listen to more episodes of the show, go to FlightSafetyDetectives.com or the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association at PAMA.org, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Catch us next time when John Golia and Greg Fife talk about all things aviation. Thanks for listening.